All right, it's time to start Unit 3 now, which is, you can call it either the metabolism unit or the energy unit or both. Both of those things are important in the unit. We're going to start this unit with a chapter that's an introduction to metabolism. And in the opening slide, what we see represented in schematic form is a biochemical pathway. A biochemical pathway is not a single reaction. It's a chain of reactions. It's an end-to-end or serial arrangement of reactions. And what I mean by end-to-end is that whatever the first reaction spits out as a product, it then serves as the reactant in the second reaction, which will turn it into a sum product that feeds the next reaction and so on, as you see here in schematic form. A gets turned into B in reaction 1, while B then gets turned into C in reaction 2, and so on. Now, a biochemical pathway is not necessarily three reactions long. It can be much longer than that. This is just an example. But however many individual reactions are in the pathway, there is a starting molecule before the pathway is entered, and eventually there is a final product represented by D here. One thing to say about pathways is that they're important in biochemistry because metabolism, remember, is the combination of all the chemical reactions that are occurring in an organism. Well, there are trillions and trillions of reactions occurring in you right now, but there are thousands of different kinds of reactions occurring in you. And almost none of those kinds of reactions occur in isolation. Almost all reactions that are occurring in an organism occur as part of a pathway, not just as a single reaction alone. That's one important thing. Another thing that we notice here is that there are enzymes listed here, enzyme 1, 2, and 3. A couple things to say about that. Notice how these enzymes are listed. Enzymes should never be listed either on either end, before or after an arrow. Because if you list something before an arrow, that means it's a reactant. If you list it after the arrow, that means it's a product. And an enzyme is a catalyst, remember. Catalysts aren't reactants in the reactions that they're involved in. And they therefore don't get turned into products. A hallmark of catalysts, which includes enzymes, is that they are reusable. They don't get changed by the reaction. They just help the reaction. So an enzyme should always properly be listed either above or below the arrow if it's going right to left or left to right. That's one thing. Now, enzymes are catalysts, as I was just saying, but what is a catalyst in general? Yes, something that speeds up a chemical reaction, and pretty drastically. Even a comparatively slow enzyme will speed the reaction up millions of times. This reaction will occur millions of times faster with the help of the enzyme than without. But molecularly, what are enzymes? Yes, they are proteins. All enzymes are proteins. And so enzymes is just the name we give to catalysts used within organisms. There's all kinds of catalysts outside of biology. But anyway, enzymes are proteins, and it's no coincidence that there are three reactions in this example and three enzymes. The point here is that effectively all reactions, chemical reactions that occur within an organism and therefore are part of metabolism, require its own enzyme to catalyze that particular reaction. So there isn't one master enzyme that we could have that would be able to catalyze all of our different kinds of chemical reactions. And we definitely would not want that to occur. Why would that be a bad thing?
Because we have to
Exactly. That means all of your possible chemical reactions would be occurring at the same time, because the enzymes allow them to happen. If you had one master enzyme, all of the possible reactions would occur. You would never want that to occur for various reasons, including the fact that some biochemical reactions achieve just the opposite of others. You wouldn't want them to work against each other at the same time. So it's never the case that in a cell all the possible reactions are occurring at the same time. And this brings up another important point about enzymes. Enzymes and catalysts, even more generally, are not required for a reaction to occur, which makes sense because they're not a reactant, right? The only thing you need is the reactant or reactants for the reaction to occur. But without the help of an enzyme speeding that reaction up, it will occur so slowly in the case of the kinds of reactions occurring in organisms that it's effectively not happening at all. So organisms need enzymes so that reactions will occur fast enough for them to remain alive, for one thing, but also, just as importantly, they're so slow without the enzyme that if you are able to control, and organisms do, control enzymes, turn them on or off, that means you are effectively also turning on or off those corresponding reactions. So biochemical pathways can be controlled by controlling the enzymes that catalyze part of that pathway. Okay, we'll give a more thorough description of what I just said in another slide. But let's go to slide 2 and start talking about energy. Energy has, there are many different forms of energy, like electromagnetic energy, which is light as an example, of chemical energy, and so on. But there are two major categories of energy that are being depicted in this example photograph. And those categories of energy are kinetic energy and potential energy. Now, potential energy is often described in books as the capacity to do some work, which is true. Potential energy is energy that is not being used at the moment, so it's often described as stored energy. It has the potential to do something if you allow it or if the system is set up properly. But at the moment, it is not being used. So think of it as stored energy. The other category, though, is kinetic energy. And kinetic energy is being used at the moment to do something. Well, the root of this is the same root as in cinema, which means moving pictures. So kinetic means moving. For instance, kinetic art. There's kinetic art, right? A mobile moves when the air blows on it. So anyway, that's the rationale for the word. What we see, though, by this picture is that there can easily be a transformation from one of these categories to the other. In other words, potential energy can be turned into kinetic energy can be turned into potential energy. Let me explain how in this example. Here we have gravitational potential energy, because this is happening in a gravitational field. Well, you are able to, well, if you climb this platform, as this person is doing, that's not going to automatically happen, right? You have to force that to happen. You have to put in the energy, the effort of climbing the stairs to get to the top. So while doing that, the person is transforming kinetic energy energy of that person's motion into greater and greater potential energy. That person's body is being invested with more gravitational potential energy, which is why the higher someone climbs, the faster they will fall if they then jump off or fall off. Okay, so kinetic energy is being transformed into potential energy to get to the top, and then jumping off reverses the process. Potential energy gets converted into the kinetic energy, which is the motion of falling. Now, in this chapter, the potential energy example that we're going to be mostly concerned with is chemical potential energy. Energy that's stored in the form of the bonds between atoms that hold together molecules. And specifically, molecules that are used for the purpose of providing energy. We call such molecules fuel. Things that we eat contain fuels. Well, they are valuable as fuels because they have a lot of chemical potential energy. So let's go on to three. Now we need to talk about thermodynamics just a bit. We're not going to get too deeply into this. We could have an entire course just on thermodynamics. It's an important branch of science dealing with energy transactions. Important not just for biology, but for all of science. And as you see here, there are some laws that we need to discuss. In this course, we only, I won't say care, but we're only going to be responsible, you are only going to be responsible for knowing two laws, but there are more than two laws. There's kind of a silliness to how this happened. There are four laws, really. And you would reasonably think that they're called the first, the second, the third, and the fourth law, but they're not. Because after they already had the first and second law established, they realized there was something more basic that they needed to stick in first. But they didn't want to change these names because they're already well established. So the four laws are the zeroth, the first, the second, and the third law. Well, we're not going to discuss the zeroth or the third, rather than just the first and the second. And the first law of thermodynamics is often rephrased or named the law of conservation of energy. Conservation refers to saving, right, in a general sense. What it means with respect to conservation of energy is that energy cannot be created or destroyed, which means in the universe, which is the set of everything, there is a set amount of energy. It doesn't go up or down. It can't be created or destroyed. Despite not being able to be created or destroyed, though, energy can be both transformed and transferred. This is all part of the first law as well. The difference between those trans words is that energy transformation means changing the energy from one form to another. For instance, sunlight striking a leaf of a plant. That's electromagnetic energy, one form originally. It gets transformed into the chemical energy of the sugars that the plant makes by photosynthesis. We'll study that in the third chapter of the unit. That's transformation, change of form. Transfer of energy just simply refers to moving energy from one object to another in the universe. A simple example of that is the breaking of a rack of billiard balls. Right? When you break, the cue ball has kinetic energy that it then transfers to the ball it hits and so on. The second law is one that is concerned with entropy. And I don't know whether you've learned about entropy in any courses before this, maybe, but Entropy, if you want to define it succinctly in one word, I guess the best word would be disorder. Roughly speaking, entropy is disorder. And one of the things that the second law of thermodynamics tells us is that the entropy in the universe is always increasing. In other words, in a sense, the universe is winding down. It's becoming more random. You know, when you want to neaten a room, it takes effort to create that order, right? You're decreasing the entropy. Well, if you can't expect it to last that way forever, right? It's just going to naturally become disordered. And that's what's happening in the universe as a whole. Entropy is increasing. But that doesn't mean there aren't little pockets of the universe that are highly ordered. There certainly are. We learned this on the first day, the very first slide, I think, that I gave you, which was the slide featuring seven things that all organisms have in common, one of which was a high degree of order. Organisms are very highly structured, highly ordered objects. This does not violate the second law of thermodynamics. But in order for an organism to be so highly ordered, you have to make the rest of the universe even more highly disordered than the order you're creating in that little subset of the universe. So when you add it all together, the overall entropy or disorder in the universe is increasing. Another important part of the second law is that there is no such thing as a perfectly efficient energy transaction. By perfectly efficient, what I mean by that, if it were to exist, is that all of the available energy gets used to do useful work. That's impossible, according to the second law, which is why there is no such thing as a perpetual motion machine, even though people keep trying to make them. Another way of saying all of this is that, according to the second law, in any given energy transaction, some energy gets lost as heat. And I say lost as heat because heat is energy that's not able to do any useful work. In a sense, it's a waste or a byproduct of the transaction. That's why we see heat coming out of here. This cat is moving, which is an expensive process, but what's powering the movement is the chemical energy of the prey item, this animal that he's eaten, beforehand. But because of the second law, it's never going to be the case that all of that energy in the form of food goes in to propel him. Just like it's never going to be the case, not even close, that all of the chemical energy in gasoline goes into propelling the vehicle down the road. It's highly inefficient. So much energy gets wasted in the process of internal combustion as heat that an engine has to have a dedicated cooling system just to keep it from seizing up because it would get so hot. Well, that's true for all energy transactions, not just cars. Organisms as well, which involve thousands of energy transactions. All right. Four involves several definitions as I make my way through this. But this is also an energy slide. I just defined the laws of thermodynamics. Now I need to use the phrase thermodynamic system. because each of these three columns and pictures here with the arrows is an example of a thermodynamic system. Well, a thermodynamic system is fairly easy to define because it can be basically anything you want it to be, as long as you say what it is. When you define a thermodynamic system by saying what it is, and it could be like here, it's this diving off the platform scenario. This middle one is a little space in which there's high concentration and diffusion happens, and this one is a chemical reaction, breaking a big molecule into smaller ones. But anyway, whatever the system is that you're defining, when you define a thermodynamic system, what you are really doing is subdividing the universe, which is everything, into two non-overlapping subsets. When you define a thermodynamic system, whatever you say the system is one subset. And everything else in the universe is the other subset, which we collectively call the surroundings. So defining a thermodynamic system divides the universe into the system and the surroundings. All right? We'll talk more about systems in a minute, but each of these systems is shown twice, on the top and on the bottom after the arrow. So this is the same system in all three cases, the same system before and after. In other words, there's a passage of time, okay, a before and an after picture. And therefore, there's a change, not just in time, but in this case, a change in energy level. So the next thing I want to define about this slide is free energy, which really is just a phrase for potential energy. Now, free energy has the symbol G. And that doesn't seem to make sense unless you realize that free energy is kind of the nickname. The long, full name of free energy is Gibbs free energy. It's the G stands for Gibbs, the dead dude that we named it in his honor. So free energy is potential energy, meaning it's, as I said before, it's not being used at the moment, but it can be used to do something. All right? G by itself as a symbol means the instantaneous value of free energy, meaning the value at that particular point in time. Well, there are two points in time for each of these example systems being shown, before and after. So there are two different values of G in each of these systems. There's a G here, whatever the value is, and there's a G later, whatever that value is, okay? If you have a change in a value before and after, then you can calculate a difference, just like mass of the potatoes before and after, right? That was delta mass. Here we want to talk about delta G, which is not the same thing as G, right? Delta G doesn't make sense unless you have two values of G to compute the delta for. And what is the proper way of computing delta? What is delta G equal by analogy with delta mass when you did the potatoes? Right. Delta G equals G final, G sub F, minus G initial, G sub I. So the initial G in each of these example systems here is whatever the value is before this event happened. And remember, the order here is important because that means if you end up with a final G that is smaller than the initial G was, you're going to be subtracting a larger number from a smaller number, and therefore the delta G value is going to be a negative. The magnitude, just the numerical size of delta G is important, but so is the sign. The sine of delta G tells us a lot. Every one of these three examples shown here has a delta G that is negative. And that's because in all three of these cases, G for the system is lower after than it was to begin with. Well, the delta, a high value of G, I should start over, a high value of G in a system corresponds to lower stability or greater instability, however you want to define it. System with high G is not very stable. Think of this guy on the diving platform. You're much more likely to fall off of a ledge than you are to fall off of the ground. It's a more unsteady situation when there's higher G. And because of that, I mean, because of the fact that thermodynamic systems tend to change to the lowest energy they can get to, that means that when you have delta G's that are negative in all of these cases, those things happen on their own. And notice the middle system. This is diffusion. We've already studied this. I've already told you about the fact that diffusion requires energy. It just doesn't require outside additional energy. The energy in the system is built in. I mean, the energy is built into the system. It is the gradient itself. It's an unstable situation to have a high concentration when there's room to spread out. So the system tends to the more stable situation of spreading out. Diffusion happens for that reason. And that means the system goes to a lower G value. Okay, so G is just one important part about this. There are three antonymous pairs I'm going to give you of words. They're antonyms. What are antonyms? Opposite meaning words, exactly. Like up, down is an antonymous pair. One of these is spontaneous. A spontaneous process is one that can happen on its own. The antonym is simply non-spontaneous. A non-spontaneous process can happen, but it can never happen on its own. You have to force a non-spontaneous process to occur. All three of these examples are spontaneous if they occur from top to bottom, the way they're listed. So it's easy to spontaneously fall, right? Gravity takes care of that. You can try over and over. It's never going to happen that you're going to spontaneously rise to the deck. You have to force that to happen by putting energy into climbing. Similarly, diffusion happens on its own. That's a spontaneous process. You can force it backwards, but you're going to have to supply energy to do that. And the third example system here is a reaction. So remember, I said a thermodynamic system could be anything you want as long as you define it. Well, an individual chemical reaction is a thermodynamic system. And actually, most of the systems we'll be talking about after I get through this general discussion of systems will be chemical reactions. But in this chemical reaction, notice what's happening. It's a larger, more complex molecule being broken into smaller and multiple pieces. Well, that's a spontaneous process as well. Okay? Spontaneous processes are easy to spot in terms of delta G. Negative values of delta G correspond to spontaneous processes, including reactions. Okay? Non-spontaneous would have a positive delta G, which all of these would if you ran them uphill instead of downhill. All right. So this one antonymous pair, spontaneous, non-spontaneous, describes whether or not that thing is going to be able to happen on its own. I say that because the other two pairs that I'm going to give you can describe the same system, but they describe a different aspect of the system. With spontaneous or non-spontaneous, what we're concerned with is whether it can happen on its own. And importantly, by the way, before I get off spontaneity, spontaneous means only that it can happen. It does not at all tell you whether this is going to happen anytime soon. And that's related to what I was talking about before on enzymes. Chemical reactions in the body can be spontaneous, but without the help of an enzyme, they can be so slow that they're effectively off. So the speed of a reaction has nothing to do with the spontaneity. Okay, the second pair of words has to do with what happens with energy. And the first of these is exergonic. The opposite of that is endergonic. The ergon part of this word is a root that means energy. And ex or exo means out, endo means in. So exergonic linguistically means energy comes out. Remember, energy doesn't get destroyed or created, but it can move around. So an exergonic reaction is one that releases energy. That's what this third system is an example of. This is a reaction, and it's exergonic. Well, the negative delta G tells you that as well. It's exergonic. So I wrote exergonic right under spontaneous because they go hand in hand. But they describe different aspects of the same system, right? Spontaneity describes whether it's going to happen on its own. Exergonic describes what happens with the energy. It comes out. Endergonic means energy has to go into the system, which is why that system is never going to change. You know, that endergonic process is never going to happen on its own. You have to force it to happen by supplying that energy. Okay, so endergonic processes have positive delta G values. And if you can run this reaction uphill, as it's listed, and we do this all the time, we can make, you know, the reason this large complex molecule exists is because a cell made it to begin with by assembling these smaller ones in a certain way to build it. But the reason, by the way, that this top version of this system corresponds to instability, like all these do at first, higher G, remember, means more unstable. The reason this is more unstable is because these atoms that are part of this large complex molecule aren't as free to move around individually. They have fewer degrees of freedom, as we say in science. Yes, the entire molecule can move in about any direction it wants, but all of the atoms are going to be in position relative to that molecule, stuck there, right? They can't go any direction they want with respect to each other. But when you break it apart, each of these smaller molecules now can move individually. So there's more freedom. It's a less constrained system to have a bunch of smaller, less complex molecules. Okay, exergonic, endergonic is the second pair. The third pair of words describes metabolic reactions. So not all systems are reactions, but reactions are systems, and those are the systems we're going to study mostly. So these two words that are opposites of each other also happen to be the two subsets, the two non-overlapping subsets of metabolism. I don't remember whether I've given you these already, have I?
No.
Okay, what are they?
Metabolism.
Or yes. Catabolism is the next one I'm going to write under spontaneous and exergonic. Or I'm going to use the adjective form, catabolic. And then the opposite of that is anabolic down here. Catabolism, remember, is the breakdown of larger, more complex molecules into smaller, less complex molecules. Just like what's happening in this third example here. This is a catabolic reaction if it goes from top to bottom, according to the arrow. And that's an important part of metabolism, but that's only one part. Organisms require large complex molecules, and they build them out of smaller, less complex molecules. So this has to be able to be forced to happen in the other direction as well. If you force it uphill in this example, that would be an anabolic reaction. And a major theme of this chapter, of this unit, is that we use energy that's released from catabolic reactions to drive various anabolic processes that have to happen in the cell. I'll get back to that with other pictures, but we're going to be talking a lot about it. But I group them this way because even though these three pairs describe different aspects, they go hand in hand. So a spontaneous process is exergonic, a catabolic reaction is exergonic and spontaneous, and so on. They all go hand in hand. On the other hand, all these other ones go hand in hand. If a reaction is endergonic, then it's non-spontaneous. Anabolic reactions are non-spontaneous. You have to force them to happen. Okay, now to five. Armed with all of those definitions, it's easier to understand, hopefully, these graphs. We have two graphs here, red and blue, but we are graphing the same thing in the y-axis, free energy. So remember, that's G, potential energy. And it's not delta G that's being plotted, it's G, meaning the particular value, the Y value, is the G at that moment. The X-axis is progress of the reaction, which is just another phrase for time, really, right? So before the reaction, after the reaction. So there's a G value before, and then there's a G value after. You can then compute delta G, which is the difference vertically on the graph between the beginning and ending values. So what's different, other than the color, between the top graph and the bottom, is that the first reaction is exergonic. You would know that even if it's not labeled exergonic, because you can see that the energy value, the value of G, is going down. Therefore, delta G is small minus large, which is a negative value. Negative delta G means exergonic. Energy is released. So this is what our fuels are all about. Fuels that are contained in the food that we eat can be catabolized, broken down, which is an exergonic process, releases energy, and then we can put that energy to use, forcing various anabolic and endergonic processes to occur. The bottom one is an endergonic process, right? So the final value of G is higher, therefore it's large minus small, delta G is positive. You have to force that to happen. That's why energy in the bubble here is coming into the situation. So which one of these is spontaneous?
The top one.
Yes. Bottom one, non-spontaneous. Okay, now we need to talk in slide 6 in greater detail about thermodynamic systems. All I've told you so far is that they can be anything you want as long as you say what it is, and that's true. But there are categories of thermodynamic systems, and in this course I want to define 3 categories, especially because the book is wrong about this. The book I took this from is wrong, which I'll explain in a minute. But let me give you the categories of systems. One category is an open system. Another is a closed system. And a third is an isolated system. Here's the difference. An open thermodynamic system is able to exchange both energy and matter with the surroundings. A closed thermodynamic system is able to exchange energy with the surroundings, but it's not able to exchange material with the surroundings. And an isolated system is not able to exchange either energy or materials, which is just what you would think of as isolated, right? It's on its own, cut off from everything else. Well, there is no real thing as an isolated system. No such thing. It is really just a thought exercise to help clarify the science. You know, there sometimes we try to get as close as we can to an isolated system. For instance, a very well-designed Dewar flask or thermos bottle is in science labs are called Dewar flasks, but it's basically the same thing. Kind of approximates an isolated system. It is closed, so there is no exchange of materials. And it's designed in such a way that there's not very easy transfer of energy between the system and the surroundings. But you can't cut it off entirely. You can't expect, after 3 years, to open up your thermos and have hot soup still. It's going to be cold by then, or it's going to be the same temperature as the surroundings. So there is no such real thing as an isolated system, and that's why this is wrong. The publisher got this wrong. This is not an isolated system that we're looking at in A. Why can you tell, other than the label isolated, or which is wrong, I told you, why can you tell just by looking at the picture that this is not isolated? Well, that's true, but that doesn't violate it being isolated. So you have sealed chambers here, water flows from one to the other, turns a turbine, and lights a light. Why is that? Well, it has to be sharing energy or matter for it to not be isolated, right? It is not sharing water, so material is staying there. The light, the fact that you can see this light, you're part of the surroundings. The fact that you can see this light, it means that energy is escaping the system, right? So it is not isolated. This is they should have labeled this a closed hydroelectric system. But the way this happens is that you have a gravitational gradient in place, right? Water wants to fall. There's a gradient because there's a higher level of water in this tank, lower level in this tank, so that's the tendency for water to fall, and it's designed in such a way that the only way it can fall is through this tunnel that turns the turbine, and that generates electrical current, and that's why the light lights. But no water can enter or leave since it's a closed system, and therefore, eventually, it will come to gravitational equilibrium, right? The situation in which the water level is the same in both tanks, water's not going to continue falling at that point. And therefore, it's going to stop turning the turbine. Electricity is no longer being made. The reason this is shown here is not because we really care about hydroelectric systems in this course. It's just to tell you that this is not a very good analogy for an organism, a living organism. No organism is a closed thermodynamic system. It's impossible to be living and be a closed thermodynamic system. And that's because to remain alive, whether it's one cell or a multicellular organism, the organism has to nearly continuously exchange both materials and energy with the surroundings, which by definition makes every living organism an open thermodynamic system. That's why B, the open hydroelectric system, is a better analogy than A is. A doesn't describe us at all. B does a little bit better. It's open because water's coming in and water's going out. And they're designed this in such a way that however much is leaking out, that same amount goes in continuously. That maintains the gradient. So there will always be a change in the difference in the water levels, and therefore water keeps spilling downhill and keeps lighting the light. The lighting of the light is an analogy of life. It'll never come to thermodynamic equilibrium, which would be death, the light out. But even though that's a better analogy, it's true that all organisms are open systems, the best analogy of the three shown here is C, a multi-step open system. That is the same delta G, by the way. The delta G is represented by the difference in the water levels. And that difference, which is in one shot in B, is the same as the overall distance from the very beginning and the very end in the multi-step. The importance of this will become more clear later, but what this is representing, this multi-step hydroelectric system, is that when we extract the energy from our fuel molecules, which is what we'll study in the second chapter, we don't release all of that energy in one explosive step, which is what B would represent. That would be, not only would it be too much energy released at once and would kill the organism, but also it wouldn't give nearly as much opportunity to usefully harness that released energy. It would just be an explosive release of heat. Instead, when we burn our fuels, which is kind of what this is representing, we do so in steps, releasing just a little bit of energy at a time. And in many of those steps, some of that energy gets put into storage, which we'll talk about later. That can keep us alive. All right. Now, so I shouldn't have said later because it's right now. Slide 7 shows you the most important, not the only, but the most important storage molecule for the purpose of storing energy. What is this molecule we're looking at? Well, if you can't recognize it by looking at it, which is understandable because we haven't studied it yet, what have you learned is the most important energy storing molecule in other courses, I mean? Have you studied this at all ever? Okay, well, this is ATP. This is one ATP molecule, which is an abbreviation for adenosine triphosphate. Now, this is actually a double-duty molecule. You have seen this before, or something very similar to it, because we've discussed it for one of its uses. G Do you know where? What is ATP an example of molecularly? What kind of molecule that you know of contains a pentose sugar, a nitrogenous base hooked to that sugar, and a phosphate hooked to that sugar? A nucleotide, which is a monomer. You can use one or more of those to build a nucleic acid of any size you want. That's what I meant by saying that this is a double duty molecule. When we talked about nucleic acids in that chapter, I defined a nucleotide as a subunit, and I said that any nucleotide has to have a pentose sugar. Well, remember, there were two choices for the pentose, either deoxyribose or ribose. It's not really a choice, because if you're building a DNA molecule, you have to have deoxyribose as your sugar in every nucleotide. And if you're building RNA, all of the sugars have to be ribose. But this is a single nucleotide in which the sugar is ribose. And this is adenine up here, which is one of the five nitrogenous bases that are commonly used in nucleic acids. But remember, DNA uses four of those five, and RNA uses four of those five that aren't the same. But anyway, this is adenine. And then you have at least one phosphate. So this is a nucleotide that we're looking at. ATP is a nucleotide. And so it could be used as a monomer, along with other nucleotides, to build an RNA. That's one important job that this molecule has. But it also has an entirely separate side gig that's really important, too. And that is to serve as an energy storing molecule. Very short term energy storing. But that's really important for reasons we'll get into in a little bit. Okay, now, do you remember when I first defined a nucleotide? Did I tell you what this thing would be called if it didn't have any phosphates, if it's just the sugar and the nitrogenous base together? Did I say what that word is? Maybe not. If you have a pentose sugar and a nitrogenous base, and that's it, then the combination of those is called a nucleoside. Be careful with that word, because it's an S instead of a T, otherwise it's identical. The reason that I'm mentioning this is because the requirements of being a nucleotide are that you have at least one phosphate. So it is true that ATP is a nucleotide. But when you say you have a nucleotide, it's ambiguous because you don't know how many phosphates there are. You only know that there's at least one. Therefore, it is more descriptive, rather than calling this a nucleotide, to call this a nucleoside triphosphate. That's what ATP is. It's a nucleoside triphosphate. That phrase tells you explicitly how many phosphates there are. Three. All right? Now, there are multiple different kinds of nucleosides, because there are not only two kinds of sugar you can use, but also there's different kinds of nitrogenous bases. But for the job of carrying energy, as opposed to being a monomer for building nucleic acids, the most often used nucleoside is ribose with adenine. And that particular nucleoside is named for adenine. It's called adenosine. Adenosine by itself means ribose and adenine combined. So that's why this particular nucleoside triphosphate is adenosine triphosphate. The adenosine is the particular nucleoside in this molecule. But there's also an important energy-carrying molecule, very similar, except it uses guanine instead, and that's called guanosine triphosphate, because guanosine is guanine and ribose. The reason that this thing works as an energy-storing device is because there's quite a bit of chemical potential energy locked up in the form of phosphate-phosphate bonds, a bond between a phosphate and another phosphate. And so the phosphates of the ATP is really the part of the molecule that matters with respect to storing the energy. Okay? The fact that there's a lot of energy in these bonds means that building this thing is expensive. You can't just pop this into existence. You have to force it to be built. When you build a large, more complex molecule out of smaller, less complex things, you should already expect that to be endergonic, right? Anabolic and endergonic and non-spontaneous. Well, how is it that we can build this? We build it by using some of the energy that's released by the catabolic, exergonic, spontaneous release of energy when we burn fuel that comes from our food. In other words, by building an ATP, we are transferring some of the energy that was in the fuel originally into this temporary storage device called ATP. Not because we really want the ATP, but because it will store the energy. And we can then, some short time after that's built, it can then be dismantled again to release the energy. Just like using a battery after you charge it up. Okay, let's go to 8 and look at the use of an ATP. I say use, when we use ATP, we're spending it as another name. We're going from top to bottom here. But this is a reversible reaction. It's not shown as reversible. It's just a downward arrow. Because that's how we're going to discuss it. But it's reversible, as I just said. You can build this thing, but then you can also dismantle it. Dismantling an ATP is how we use it usefully. How we get the energy back out of it that we have stored in there earlier. So assuming you already have an ATP, a lot of energy in these phosphate-phosphate bonds. And I'll say once again that a P with a circle in it is just a symbol for the entire phosphate group, not for just a phosphorus atom. So there's oxygens in there as well. Okay. So ATP, if it is used, needs to be partially dismantled. Well, look at this reaction and tell me what is happening here chemically. What kind of reaction is this? It's a hydrolysis reaction, which is why it requires water. Remember, we break bigger things into smaller chunks with hydrolysis. That's true for ATP as well. But the specific part that we break is the terminal phosphate-phosphate bond between the third and the second phosphate. That's why once this hydrolysis has occurred, what you end up with is also an energy storing device, but just not with as much energy. And that's called adenosine diphosphate, ADP, because there's now only two phosphates hooked to it. Well, the other phosphate doesn't get destroyed. It's just now on its own. And so we abbreviate this with P circle sub I. The I stands for inorganic. This is an inorganic phosphate. What does inorganic mean? Doesn't have any carbon, right. This is now just phosphorus and oxygen atoms, a phosphate group on its own. These ones don't have carbon in the group, but they are part of an overall carbon skeleton. So these are part of an organic molecule. This one isn't anymore. And so it's just part of the inorganic phosphate pool that's always in cells. The next moment, it might be hooked to another ADP to turn it back into an ATP. So you should think of ADP as a still useful but not fully charged battery in the battery analogy. ATP, fully charged. And therefore carrying a lot more energy than ADP. But this just goes back and forth. When we spend ATP, we turn it into ADP. When we want to store energy that we get by burning our fuels, we capture that energy to force this uphill and turn ADP and inorganic phosphate into ATP. Okay, now nine. Let's look at how this works with an example. The specific example here is really not what's important, but we can at least talk about it as a specific example. The point here, though, in general, is that a cell, any kind of cell, has all kinds of endergonic processes, including endergonic reactions, that have to occur for the cell to remain alive. Well, endergonic processes are never going to occur on their own because they're non-spontaneous, right? They're still vitally important, though. So the cell has to have them happen. Since they're endergonic and non-spontaneous, they have to be forced to happen by supplying that system, the reaction, with energy from outside of the system. That outside source of energy often, most often, is ATP. Okay? Now, let's look at the top endergonic reaction. It's endergonic as listed, but you can tell even without the label it's endergonic because the delta G for this is a positive value. Glutamic acid is just one of the amino acids. You don't have to know anything about the particulars of this. I'm just explaining it. So glutamic acid and ammonia, the other reactant, can be combined into glutamine, which is useful stuff for the cell. So the cell at the moment needs some glutamine. It can build it, but that's never going to happen on its own, is the point, because it's non-spontaneous and endergonic. Okay, now look at the second row here. Glutamic acid and ATP react to form a phosphorylated glutamic acid, one that has a phosphate stuck onto it, and that phosphate came from ATP, which is why what's left over is ADP. The phosphate got transferred from ATP to glutamic acid. Well, just like that extra phosphate energizes ADP into a higher energy, ATP, sticking that phosphate onto glutamic acid energizes it. All right. Now, if you start with a phosphorylated glutamic acid with ammonia, then it will readily form glutamine and off pops the phosphate as inorganic phosphate. So the idea here is that endergonic processes or endergonic reactions can be coupled with exergonic reactions, and exergonic reactions release energy. By coupling the two, that forces the endergonic reaction to occur. We can see that with the final accounting numerically at the bottom here. Glutamic acid and ammonia becoming glutamine as a positive delta G. This is just the same as the top without the pictures. That's the reaction that the cell wants to happen. But it's non-spontaneous because of the positive delta G. The hydrolysis of ATP as its own separate system is an exergonic reaction. You can tell that with the negative value of delta G. ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate. So if you couple the two processes, really what you're doing thermodynamically is redefining this as a one system, including both former separate systems. And therefore, the delta G for this bigger system is the sum of those two delta Gs, which in this case, notice, is negative 3.9 kilocalories per mole. So combining the exergonic and the endergonic reaction into one by coupling them allows you to have an overall exergonic process, and therefore spontaneous, and therefore able to happen on its own. The release of energy from the exergonic part forces the endergonic part to happen. Now, notice that this overall delta G is negative because it's negative 7.3 plus positive 3.4. The positive 3.4 means that the desired endergonic reaction requires that much energy. If it doesn't, as you see, but if ATP hydrolysis had a delta G of exactly negative 3.4, would this happen? Would the coupling cause this endergonic reaction to occur? You say no, which is correct, but why? That's part of it, yes. Another way you can explain this is because of the second law of thermodynamics. I said that no thermodynamic process is 100% efficient, right? It's always going to be the case that some energy gets lost as heat, which doesn't do any work. So if you had exactly as much released, some of that's going to be left as heat, and what you have left over is not enough to get up to 3.4. Well, in actuality, though, the hydrolysis of ATP releases a lot more energy than you need. So even with the wasted heat, it's still enough to force the endergonic process to happen. That's the point here of coupling. Okay, 10. In 10, we're looking at two major kinds of cellular work that can be performed by spending ATP. ATP is not the only storage device in cells. We'll talk about others, but it's the most important, and not just in us, in all cells. But the first category of work is labeled here by this book as transport work, but that's kind of vague. That simply means moving things. It's really more specific than that. It should be transmembrane transport work. And I've already used that phrase in an earlier chapter. Transmembrane transport refers to moving something either into or out of a cell through the membrane. Okay, well, if this is transmembrane transport that's requiring ATP, what kind of transmembrane transport would it be classified as? Active transport, exactly. You don't need ATP for transmembrane transport that is passive because the energy source is the gradient. The delta G is negative, so the G is higher at first before the diffusion takes place. That's where the energy comes from. You end up with lower G after the diffusion happens. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about forcing something to move against its gradient, from where there's already a lower concentration to where there's already a higher concentration. In other words, stockpiling it. That's never going to happen on its own. It's endergonic and it's non-spontaneous, so you have to supply ATP. But that's what should have been labeled as transmembrane transport work here. The other is mechanical work, which is also transport. But in this case, mechanical work refers to moving things around from one place in the cell to another, not getting things into or out of the cell through the membrane. And this involves motor proteins, for instance. We've studied this before, right? A motor protein is carrying a vesicle, which is the cargo, whatever it's trying to move from place to place. But the motor protein itself takes one step at a time along a microtubule. And every single step requires a fresh ATP to be spent. So it's expensive stuff. So there's just quadrillions and quadrillions of ATPs and ADPs in your pool of storage molecules, and they're going back and forth between ADP form and ATP form. But when you're spending them, when you're using them for one of these work processes, you're going from ATP to ADP. To get them back to ATP so you can remain alive, you have to eat, burn your fuel, which releases energy, and the energy that's released from the fuels allows us to stick that extra phosphate on to make it ATP. That's kind of schematized in slide 11 here, but there's something else I want to say about this. The central cycle here in the middle of the figure, which the part that involves ATP and ADP, is a good representation of how ATP is often described in textbooks. A lot of textbooks will describe ATP as the energy currency of the cell, by analogy with money, right? That's a good analogy for several reasons. So let's talk about currency outside of biology, money. At least nowadays, effectively no one works directly for the things that person needs. You don't have a job for which you get housing, or a job for food only, or a job for clothes, right? What you work for, at whatever you do, is money, which by itself is pretty worthless. But money represents the effort of your job, the work that you performed. All right? And the reason it's valuable is because it's so versatile. You know, you wouldn't want to have a job just for food, because you need things other than just food. And it would be a bitch to have a bunch of separate jobs, one for food, one for housing, one for clothes, one for car, whatever. So the versatility of money is the reason it's so valuable, right? Our effort is represented by the money that we earn, but the versatility comes in when we spend the money. Because it's not just one thing you can spend the money on, it's all kinds of different things. Anything that you need you can buy with money, except for love, as the Beatles taught us. But in a sense here, the currency, money as currency, is an intermediary or a middleman between work and purchased things. This is a good analogy with what happens in the cell energetically. ATP is the currency of the cell because it's the energetic intermediary. What I mean by that is that it's not the case that in a cell fuels get burned to release energy that directly gets used to perform the endergonic processes that the cell has to force to happen. A cell does not do that. Instead, the energy that's released by the fuels gets put in directly into building ATP molecules that are now storing the energy, just like money stores the effort. And just like money is versatile, ATP is versatile. Because it can then be spent to force all kinds of different endergonic processes to occur. That's what this is representing. The left yellow arrow is energy that's released from the catabolism, the breakdown of our fuels. That's an exergonic process. This is the energy that's released. Some of that's lost as heat. There's nothing we can do about that. But some of it gets captured in the form of ATP, because we put that energy into sticking an inorganic phosphate onto ADP to make that ATP. That is now storing the energy that was in the food originally. But the next moment, we're going to spend it. And we're going to spend it by reversing that process. We're going to dephosphorylate ATP to turn it back into ADP and inorganic phosphate. That releases the energy, which is then, some of that's lost as heat too. Well, a bunch of that energy released by ATP can then force an endergonic process like an anabolic reaction or any of those categories of work that we just looked at in the previous slide to happen. That's what happens in general. So we'll look at the particulars of all of this later.